Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and Industry Chatter continuing now every Thursday in the 3 o'clock hour. And my guest for the remainder of the hour is Tony Busseri. He is the CEO of Route One and joining me in studio. Tony, it's great to see you. Thank you for coming in to talk about what's going on in industry today.
Great to be in warm and lovely Washington today.
It is a terrific day to be in Washington, and we're glad you're here. Let's start with a conversation about what Route One does for customers in the federal government.
Excellent. Simply put, we're in the business of securing digital communications. More specifically, when someone wants to work from home or give access to a contractor the information that's held within the government's networks, we provide a solution that's enabled by a device called a MobiKey and starts with authenticating the individual. And once that's done with a multi-factor approach, hardware-based, we support a remote access session in a way where data is never walking beyond the firewall. So we like to think of ourselves as providing a highly secure tool to leverage the workforce in a mobile experience while at the same time providing dramatic cost savings for the government. Because as we know in today's world, if we talk about security, we also have to talk about cost savings.
Is cost the pretty much the main driver that you hear when you talk to federal customers now?
I would tell you my haircut would be the security, and ultimately the smile or the cost savings closes the deal. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a paradigm out there that there's a general belief, let me back up, that says if we want security, we're going to be paying a heck of a lot more. And I think, candidly, one of our main messages has been to challenge that and say, hold on. It is industry's responsibility to provide those cost savings and better security. So that's the model we approach.
Are agencies getting better at approaching security from a life cycle cost where maybe if you apply a security solution that you think's a budget, a bargain up front, long term, it might not be. If you spend a whole lot of money on a data breach, say, you haven't saved any money.
No, and unfortunately, I think Congress has had a major influence over people's thought processes or approaches to security over the last 12 months, and that's a natural thing. Mm-hmm. And specifically, I mean, I think we're jumping to conclusions to address cost without understanding the full implications of them. In many ways, it's not a TCO or a total cost approach. It's one about immediately saving budget dollars now. Mm-hmm. And I often hear this line, well, our data is not that important, so we really don't need that better security. And there seems to be a complete miss to the point. Data doesn't know whether it's important or not. Mm-hmm. We live in a world about managing networks, and networks is where our data principally resides. And if we can inadvertently go with solutions that we think are saving us money, but in the medium and short term are going to provide very robust impacts to our organization from a cost perspective.
Do you hear that a lot, people saying my data is not that important?
On the civilian side, I would say, unfortunately, too frequently.
Mm-hmm. And what's usually the reasoning behind that? What's the mindset? Is it because it's information that's freely available other places? Or what causes someone to give you that response, do you think?
It's a reactive response to the fact my first goal is to cut cost.
Hmm. So it's not necessarily, in your view, based directly on the content of the data?
No. I mean, we're quite proud of some of the client relationships we have, one of them being with the United States Navy, working with our partner there, HP. It's interesting, when I talk to clients sometimes about that relationship, they turn it around on me and say, well, our data is not as important as the data that the Navy has. Mm-hmm. And they tend to get comfort with the fact that I may work at a civilian department, it's not as important, so I can justify the lower cost, less effective solution I'm going with.
So if you go to the other side of the desk when you're having that conversation with somebody, what do you think a good risk analysis of data status would look like? How do you do that in a way that you think is comprehensive toward understanding the value of the data that an agency holds?
See, ultimately, I don't believe we should be interpreting whether data is important or isn't. If it's important enough for us to build a firewall around that data, mm-hmm. then we've established that it needs to be protected. And whatever actions we take to access that inside the fort or outside the fort should be respecting that initial decision. And we shouldn't de-importantize, that's not a word, but make it less important, because we want to support a teleworking initiative or a remote access session. Principally, what I'm going with is the fact that if we've invested $1 or $10 million or even more than that in creating a firewall and protecting it, all our actions should be around managing the vulnerabilities and definitely not supporting a further action that's going to render that investment useless.
Now, one change that I've noticed in cybersecurity over the past 2 to 2 years, probably most commonly, is agencies are taking a data-centric approach to cybersecurity instead of a hardware-centric approach. Right. So I imagine, based on what you've said so far, that at least you do find some comfort in that approach and the way that that has changed. Is that fair for me to say?
It's absolutely fair. I might add the twist. I don't think it's a either or, and I think sometimes we ignore the authentication component of data security, and that is, we shouldn't be deciding about where we make our investments until we first established we know who the person is we're trying to give access to. And mm-hmm. The way that the question was presented to me, I think it's a fair one. I think it's a three-dimensional issue versus just two.
Okay. Are we doing a good job or not as good a job as we could on ID authentication to make sure that the people that are able to access are the people that we want to be able to access?
Look, I think we as a society have gotten ourselves comfortable that if we put in the right four-digit password into a box with the right software on that computer, that that's good authentication. It's not. It's mm-hmm. wholly, it's inadequate. One-time password solutions just aren't good enough from my perspective for our data that the government is managing. And we're a big believer that when you can authenticate an individual, you can appropriately give them their entitlements or access. And it's our job to ensure that the multi-factor authentication approaches we take are the best available. And on the civilian side of our federal government, we have a presidential directive, our Homeland Security Presidential Directive 12, mm-hmm. that under our last president was put into place and was supposed to be fully compliant with a couple of years ago. And it's not. And I think there's two we've ignored a very important part of data security, and that goes with, if we don't know who's actually accessing it and who's using it, how can we be assured that it's in the right hands? We can't.
All right. So if thinking about identity assurance from that perspective then, and you've mentioned telework a couple of times sure. in our conversation, maybe then thinking about it from that perspective, it's not such a bad idea that telework is rolling out a little more slowly at some agencies than people would like to see it rolling out.
I agree with you. And I think that would be my same comment about cloud computing as another hot topic button. Whatever initiatives we take that are going to deal with data, ultimately, I think appropriate risk analysis needs to be done with it. In consideration, are we creating additional vulnerabilities to our network as a result of the new action? Anything we do that creates greater vulnerabilities puts our interests at risk, period.
My guest is Tony Basseri. He's the CEO of Route One, my guest for Industry Chatter today. We'll continue our conversation in a moment on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
How is the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, NGA, putting the power of geospatial intelligence in the hands of its users? How does NGA support disaster rescue, homeland security, and war fighter operations? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and much more with Letitia Long, Director, National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, next week on the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to today's lottery draw. And today's winning numbers are not yours, not yours, and another number that's not yours. And the final number is not yours.
When it comes to having money, don't rely on luck. Brew your own coffee at home instead of buying that latte. Brown bag it to work instead of ordering it. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas on how to save.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and this week's Experts in Health topic is colorectal cancer, featuring Dr. Manish Jain, primary care physician for the Mid-Atlantic Permanente Medical Group, who practices at the Kaiser Permanente West End Medical Center.
I'm Dr. Manish Jain, and I want you to know that colorectal cancer is the second leading cause of cancer deaths in the United States. The lifetime risk for developing colorectal cancer is 1 in 20. Early detection and treatment can dramatically increase the chances of survival. There are three types of highly effective colon cancer screenings. One, a fecal immunochemical test, or FIT, that is non-invasive and low risk. Two, a colonoscopy, while most widely known, is also the most invasive and carries the most risk. And three, a sigmoidoscopy, a less invasive alternative. If you're 50 or older, getting colorectal cancer screening could help save your life. Talk with your doctor about how and when you should be screened. Be well and thrive.
Dr. Jain was recently recognized as a top doctor in Washingtonian Magazine. To learn more about Kaiser Permanente's Experts in Health, visit kp.org/midatlantic and click Meet Our Doctors.
Powered by the latest second-generation Intel Xeon processors, new HP ProLiant G7 servers are a perfect high-speed solution for lowering costs, improving utilization, and reducing server sprawl. GovConnection, a federal elite HP partner, can show you how together they can power your data center into the future. Talk to GovConnection's experienced federal sales team, where service and commitment to the customer are priority one. Call 800-800-0019 today.
Vitamin D and prediabetes. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Nicholas Garlow with HHS HealthBeat. New data show that compared to normal weight children, obese children have lower vitamin D levels. Prediabetes is a condition in which someone is thought to be at high risk for developing type 2 diabetes. Dr. Michelle Hutchison is at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center at Dallas.
Those children with the lowest levels of vitamin D in their blood were also the children that seemed to be at the highest risk of having prediabetes as measured by a marker for insulin resistance.
Teenagers had lower vitamin D levels than younger children, partly because they often skipped breakfast and drank more soda. The study in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism was supported by the National Institutes of Health. Learn more at hhs.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Nicholas Garlow.
In the beloved fairy tale Beauty and the Beast, Belle and the Beast learn that true beauty is found within and live happily ever after. Today, our happily ever afters are being threatened by the fact that nearly one in three children in America are overweight or obese. Now is the time to make good nutrition and physical activity part of your family's daily lifestyle. To learn more, visit letsmove.gov, brought to you by Let's Move, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the Ad Council.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest on Industry Chatter today, Tony Basseri. He's the CEO of Route One. And we talked a little bit in the first segment, Tony, about identity assurance. One of the issues that agencies are dealing with when it comes to things like telework and just mobility computing in general. What do you view as kind of the state of identity assurance in government today? And what are agencies doing well? And what are the missing pieces? What's the room for improvement in your view?
Great question. Lots of answers to it. I'll start with by giving the compliment to government, whether it be civilian or defense. First of all, our belief is government's ahead of the private sector by a couple of years, if you want to use that as a benchmark. And before we talk about identity assurance or identity management, there's three core aspects to that. And how do we know someone is who they say they are? Well, there's you can have something physical, you can have something you know, and then something that's unique to you, like biometrics. In today's environment, the standard in the private sector too often is what we call single-factor authentication, which commonly is a password into a box when we do online banking is a great example of that.
Mm-hmm.
Some government agencies have moved towards multi-factor authentication, which might be something you have, being a physical device, as well as something you know, which would be the password that works in association with something that you have.
Mm-hmm.
I think the state of where we are today is that we've taken a step forward to multi-factor authentication. I think tablets, the introduction in the marketplace, is challenging the application of hardware or the physical something you have with something you know by us getting somewhat lazy by thinking that a one-time password generator that's built into that tablet is true multi-factor authentication. I think the reality is it's about one and a half. It's not single. It's not multi-factor. So where I'd say the state of affairs are is that we were moving towards true hardware-based multi-factor authentication with HSPD-12. We're big supporters of that directive, obviously. We think the advance of tablets and an introduction in the marketplace is challenging that and taking us backwards from my perspective. There are solutions that can be used to adapt and improve identity management with tablets, but I think we're definitely being challenged with the tablet introduction. So if I go back to the original question, I think government is in a gray area right now with which way they're going to go around embracing true identity assurance.
In your view, how did the HSPD-12 issue and the progress that was being made there get derailed?
Well, I think there's a couple answers to that. I think first of all, the first step that was taken was the issuance of what we call generically ID1 cards. Mm-hmm. On the civilian side, it's a first responder card or a FRAC card or a PIV card, a personal identification card. And on the military side, that's called a CAC or a common access card. The issuance of those tools then gave us something physical. When we entered a building, when we sat down at our PC inside an operations center, we would take those tools and swipe them and then put in our password. And that was a definite step forward. Where the challenge arose is how do we use that same technology or approach for remote access or teleworking? And clearly there needed to be some form of device that could read it and be incorporated in with a remote access tool. And that got stalled because there really aren't that many good solutions available in the marketplace. It's a self-serving comment for me to make because we deliver that. But that the challenge is that. I think the second challenge is that a lot of technology leaders believe that good security or good identity assurance revolves around spending more money.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're stuck in that paradigm, we're never going to look outside and say, is there a better way of delivering that? And that really goes to the full adoption of HSPD-12 means I should have no difference with my identity assurance, whether I'm outside the house or inside the house, whether I'm digital or physical.
Now, you mentioned the progression from single-factor authentication to multi-factor authentication, and you used the online banking analogy as an example of that. And we can talk about policy and technology all day long. Ultimately, if the end user won't do it, it's not going to work. I get hacked off when I go on my credit union site and they ask me for the questions to confirm that it's really me. And that's a very minor inconvenience. When you have a technology solution where people don't want to participate and where they insist on using password as their password, when that's still the end user mentality by and large, how do you try to get people on board to understand the importance of this who maybe don't do identity assurance as their daily job?
Well, if we look at the banking sector since we've started to go down this path, I think there's one or two ways with it. I think if we talk to somebody who's had thousands of dollars stripped from their bank account and they had to fight for 18 months to get that replenished by their bank, they might tell you a different answer. So it's driven by personal experience. But I think the real answer here is for industry not to be regulated, but for industry to recognize that improved security for their users is going to save them money. Look, ultimately, the banking sector went to online banking not because they wanted to be cool with the internet. They went there because it saved them money with tellers and physical assets, etc. And I think that the next evolution here is for our banking leaders to embrace or to take a hard look at the fact that the technology currently being deployed could say, you know, if they advance it, there could be dramatic savings. And once they go down that path, then we know the banks are great at marketing to their users why there should be a change.
So let's apply that template then to the federal government where, as we talked about earlier, cost savings is driving, or at least in the background of pretty much every decision that's being made right now. What does it look like there to you?
Well, I think, unfortunately, government's a little bit like a big ship. They're unable to be agile and turn on a dime. And so in response to an immediate need to cut costs or save costs, they're going to go to the easiest and the quickest way of doing that and just to adopt solutions that are just cheaper in the short term. And I think the behavior that's caused through these budget cycles is not in our best interest longer term.
My guest is Tony Basseri. He is CEO of Route One, my guest on Industry Chatter on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment.
Caps fans, don't miss a big upcoming battle at Verizon Center against the Montreal Canadiens on Fan Appreciation Day, Saturday, March 31st at 7 p.m. as the Caps continue their drive for the playoffs powered by Constellation Energy. The Caps look to pick up valuable points to secure an Eastern Conference playoff spot. Caps games are always huge events. The fans are always pumped up, always a great time, and there are only two home games left in the regular season. This is the hottest ticket in town. Tickets are very limited, so call 202-397-SEAT or log on to WashingtonCaps.com/singleticks and do your part in building a America's hockey capital.
I love my husband, but I didn't realize our difficulties had to do with his drinking. Our pastor suggested I go to Al-Anon family groups. I didn't think I would be comfortable, but I decided to try a meeting. The Al-Anon meeting really opened my eyes. Are you troubled by someone's drinking? You might be surprised at what you can learn in an Al-Anon family group meeting from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-Al-Anon.
Federal pay and benefits are taking center stage in the 2013 budget debate. President Obama has proposed a 0.5% pay increase for feds, while Republicans are calling for a federal pay freeze through 2015. Republicans also support a 10% cut to the size of the federal workforce, while both plans promote an increase in feds' contributions to their retirement accounts. FederalNewsRadio.com is your home for all of the latest budget news. Visit FederalNewsRadio.com, search term budget.
The Department of Defense faces some big changes in the coming years. I'm Federal News Radio's DoD reporter, Jared Serbu. We help you track those changes every Wednesday afternoon from 2 to 3 with On DoD. Each week, we'll talk one-on-one with defense experts and senior managers about the policies, programs, and innovations that affect warfighters and how the military will continue to meet its mission. That's On DoD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and FederalNewsRadio.com.
This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest is Tony Basseri. He is the CEO of Route One and my guest on Industry Chatter today on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We've touched a little bit on mobile computing and the mobility revolution. How does that fit with what we've been talking about with identity assurance when agencies are trying to introduce all kinds of devices, and in fact, some agencies are already trying some pilots on bring your own device. I've told the story a number of times. I was in the audience when Vivek Kundra first announced the possibility that maybe we'll let people bring their own devices to work and put them on the network, and all of the agency IT people in the audience had just huge, the eyeballs went huge, faces went white, and all of the industry people in the audience started salivating, they were drooling. What does that mean when you're trying to take a device that maybe you don't have any of now and trying to introduce some level of identity assurance there?
It's a nightmare. I mean, let's start with the obvious point. The corporation I'm involved with fundamentally believe that data should always stay behind the firewalls, should not move beyond it, should not be on devices that they can't guarantee security or who's using them, etc. BYOD as a principle isn't bad, nor is teleworking bad, nor is cloud computing bad. But as we talked about earlier, if we rush into embracing them, without understanding the security implications, it's going to be a nightmare. And BYOD, I think, is the worst of it. There recently was an article about the U.S. Air Force looking to deploy a substantive number of iPads.
Mm-hmm.
And 1 week they came out with the announcement that they might buy up to 18,000 of them. A week or two later, they came out and said they're stopping and moving backwards on that because there's some security concern with the tablet. Not my words, but it was printed, obviously, in the article. I think the point here was not criticizing the iPad because it's not the iPad that's the problem. It's how we're using technology and how we're addressing the due diligence that's required up front before we embrace it. Government, in particular defense, doesn't have a margin for error. And I am concerned as an American that we rush too quickly to adopt sexy, cool flavors of the month before we understand the implications of them. I understand we want to attract the right type of people in the government. I understand we want to look at ways to dramatically saving costs. I understand we want more functionality, but the threat of a loss of life or data and the serious consequences that we've learned through the WikiLeaks fiasco, I just don't think we can afford something more grossly negligent than that. I it's a real risk.
The incident that you referred to, the situation you referred to at the Air Force, the reason they went back and revisited that was because the software that they were going to use for the flight bags, these iPads were going to be deployed in flight bags for special ops aircraft. And the software that they chose was from a Russian company. And some folks became alarmed at the idea that a company with potential ties to the Russian government would be in the flight bags of special ops Air Force aircraft, understandably so. And so they went back to the drawing board there. If we tear that apart based on what you're talking about, you said the problem is not with the iPads. The problem's not with the hardware. So the other piece of that that's left is the software, and I didn't take away that you're picking particularly on those on that software company or whatever, but is there any room for margin, or are these technologies, in your view, still just a little too open, still just a little too not quite tested well enough yet?
Yes, the simple answer is that we're not ready to adopt on enterprise-wide basis is some of the new gadgets in the marketplace. Fundamentally, and look, it plays into the model that I espouse and believe in. If data is never coming onto that device, I'm less concerned about its underlying securities, API, et cetera. What I then put the responsibility on is the organization and where that data resides. If I then use a tablet, pick your name, to be nothing more than a screen and a keyboard, I'm okay with that because the data is never coming to it. So, I think it goes to how you're architecting the solution to address that objective. Look, it is obvious that people carrying around in bags tons of books, there's a much more efficient way to do it, and tablets potentially form a great solution for that problem. I don't know the exact reasons why, but I think we moved a little too quickly on that scenario.
How what does the architecture then look like? Is it I'm trying to envision in my mind a case where you have information on the network and the network pushes that information out to the device and I mean
that information should never be pushed out. It should be much along the lines of that tablet is getting a picture, an encrypted screenshot from our perspective of what's actually happening back on the asset inside the network, whether that be a virtual or physical asset. And so your screen, the model we believed in was there in 1976, mainframe computer, dummy terminals. In this case, you don't have a cord, and it's an imaginary cord that's just very, very long.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we understand why the industry moved towards personal computing. Fair enough. But there was good principles, good architecture that were first evidenced in the 70s that I believe are applicable in today's environment to support teleworking.
Is that part of the problem then, maybe, that vision is something that people are saying, well, that sounds like the old mainframe days, and we left those behind a long time ago, so that can't possibly work today, regardless of what we have to think about security. Is maybe part of the big problem here just perception?
Well, look, we have two of the largest corporations in the world dictating the message. Apple and Google have a message. It's centric around the individuals. They're going to tell us what supports their business model, and we're bombarded with those messages. We at Route One have decided we don't have the balance sheet or the soapbox to stand up and try and argue that. But ultimately, their message is dictating what's happening in enterprise. Why are tablets a quote-unquote issue? Well, because as an individual, I want that toy. And then I say, why can't I use this in my business environment, whether that be private sector or public sector? Let's be clear. The consumer is dictating the architecture right now for enterprise. Mm-hmm. And that generally is not the right way to get the best outcome.
How do you take control of that if you're running the enterprise? How do you get control of that back? Or do you recognize that the horse is already out of the barn, it's too late to close the door, and so I'm just going to try to figure out the best solution based on what I have to deal with today?
Well, I think it's okay to adopt a little slower. I think ultimately we have some very bright people. Some of our clients and the technologists we deal with are phenomenally bright people that, going back almost 2 years ago, were considering how the tablet's going to have an impact on their enterprise. To their credit, they said, we're going to control how we adopt it, how we use it, and get the best benefit out of it. I think there are those, unfortunately, that are pressured by budgetary issues or other reasons that do the wrong thing.
Tony Basseri is my guest. He's the CEO of Route One, and we'll continue our conversation in a moment on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's Industry Chatter on In-Depth with Francis Rose.
Are you a civilian employee of the intelligence community, the Department of Defense, or the Department of State? You may be eligible for term life insurance from GEBA, the Government Employees Benefit Association, with coverage issued by the Prudential Insurance Company of America. Term life insurance helps provide security for your family in case something happens to you. It's money to pay your mortgage or your children's college expenses, or help ensure your spouse can retire in comfort. GEBA's group life plan offers affordable rates with coverage amounts up to $600,000. Civilian employees of the intelligence community, the Department of Defense, or the Department of State. Don't let these exclusive benefits pass you by. Start planning today and get peace of mind for your family and protection for their future. Visit GEBA.com/term life to learn more or to download an enrollment form. That's GEBA.com/term life. Group term life coverage for GEBA is issued by the Prudential Insurance Company of America, 751 Broad Street, Newark, New Jersey, 07102. Contract series 83500.
Here's an inspiring story provided by Insperity.
Hi, I'm Tony Sterling, Vice President of Project Support Services Incorporated, a service-disabled veteran-owned small business. We provide project and contract support services to federal, state, and local government. I wear many hats in my job, as I'm sure most of you do, in small and mid-market companies. In 2008, we had only 46 employees. Now, thanks to Insperity's diverse spectrum of services, we have 156 employees and a true national footprint. One of the keys to our rapid growth is Insperity. They give us the resources of a large corporation in areas like HR, payroll, recruiting, training, and consulting on compliance issues. It's comforting to know that we have Insperity in our corner.
Insperity understands the many challenges faced by the federal contracting community. You need the right resources to give you the competitive advantage. Insperity's multi-state infrastructure gives you big company resources without compromising your status. Call 800-465-3800 or visit Insperity.com. Insperity, inspiring business performance.
More than 60% of the world's air traffic is guided by Lockheed Martin systems. To streamline air traffic control, reduce delays, and increase safety, Lockheed Martin has created a world-class data communications team. Our team is comprised of leading experts in air traffic management, telecommunications, and air-to-ground interoperability. Working in harmony with the FAA, we are the right team to orchestrate a symphony of flights from beginning to end. For more information, go to LockheedMartin.com/datacom.
To balance new cuts with new spending in the FY 2013 budget, federal agencies are achieving savings through emerging technologies. Largely led by chief technology officers, agencies are rewriting the rulebook on areas like shared services, commodity IT, cloud computing, and cybersecurity. Join AFSEA Bethesda April 10th at the Bethesda North Marriott as a panel of CTOs from federal agencies discusses federal IT transformation from the bottom up. Register today at afseabethesda.org/APRbreakfast.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. A bit more time with Tony Vasseri, the CEO of Route One, and on Industry Chatter today. One of the words that I hear from people in government a lot, we talked about the cost pressures that agencies are dealing with. A word I hear all the time is innovation. We're looking to industry for innovation. And we hear that almost as much as budget problems at this point in time. How are agencies doing at explaining to you and your colleagues in the vendor community what they expect from you when it comes to innovation? Or is that maybe the wrong question to even be asking about innovation?
No, I think some of the smartest architecting and technology minds, and it may come as a surprise to your listeners, are within government. The relationship we have with the technology team at Customs and Border Protection, as an example, I highly respect the comments they provide us, and they are pretty good at giving us direction. And look, we provide a service. We do a lot towards responding towards their demands. And I think there is, within government, a good view of where they want to be with data security and the use of data 3 to 5 years from now.
Two things that kind of tie into that. For a long time, it seemed, especially on IT procurements, that the end user was kind of disconnected from the vendor with the acquisition shop kind of in between. Are you seeing a more of a convergence and a better convergence of the end user and the acquisition shop so that when you see requirements, the end result is not to acquire a particular gadget or piece of software, but the end result is to be able to have this person communicate with that person, that kind of thing?
Yeah, when we get direction from the technology heads within government and some of the clients we have a very robust relationship with, they're very good at spelling out what they want done. Ultimately, at times it gets frustrating because it's not overly granular and it's right, but I think they're right with what they're saying. We need to be able to do this for this amount of money, or we need to be able to satisfy this issue. And right now, industry is not doing that. I need you to be able to do that within X period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the right relationship. I think ultimately industry may not like hearing it, and our industry is right to be criticized in the security world because, I think we're too often tailoring things that we're delivering to the marketplace based off of consumer needs, not enterprise needs. But I think it's absolutely right that big government, quote unquote, gives us direction around what they want. And ultimately, industry's job is to challenge them, provide response why they think it should be tailored or adapted or changed. But let's be honest about the U.S. federal government is the largest client in the world. And they have every right to say this is the direction they want to head. And if industry's smart, they're going to listen and say, here's how we can do it.
Mm-hmm. We just have a couple of minutes left, and I'm grateful for your time today. The element of all of this that we haven't talked about yet is Congress and how they affect what the agencies do and how they can either help or not help what the agencies are trying to accomplish and how they're trying to accomplish it. In the areas in which you and your company primarily work, what is Congress doing well, and what could the agencies use some help from Congress about?
Oh, boy.
And you have like a minute.
You have a minute. Answer, please. Look, I think the reality is Congress has an inability to function with long-term mandates. I mean, the cycles are obvious about when elections happen. And too often politics gets in the middle of what's the right thing to do. As we all know, right now in Congress, there's a very active debate about how security our data security should be had within the private sector and the role of the federal government around that subject matter. And it's not a simple answer with it. And I think that debate's just started. We were talking offline before we came online today. I really think the first question should be if our federal government is going to be the benchmark. Let's get our own house in order first before we start dictating to the industry. So ultimately, what I'd like to see from Congress is direction and execution.